The middle class tend to now only have one or two children. If you are like, and there's a difference between the women and the men in this room, but if you are like medical students 10 years on from you, there have been papers written about the reproduction of medical students. One great thing about the change in doctors' terms and conditions is it's now possible to have a child and look after it as well as be a doctor. I love my dad very much. I'm afraid I never saw him as a child. But you are looking at about a quarter of you never being parents. Half of that not out of choice, as you'll know, half of it out of choice. Probably the majority of you being parents of an only child. And what happens then when it's normal to be an only child? Much easier to make friends as an only child when there are lots of other only children. And then the rest of you having two, and hardly any of you having three. That's what you're heading to. What happens when more of the world does that? And that's the kind of soft landing you could get. Very last graph, there's some pretty pictures. All this uncertainty is about this little boom here. And that's the current tiny wild baby boom going on. If it is just a baby boom, then you really are looking at stopping at 10 billion, and by 2100, stability of human population. Changes all kinds of things. If you look at the Black Death, which is one of the kind of things we have to look at, if you're trying to see what happens when population doesn't go up, you suddenly find that the price of labour increases dramatically. Human beings become more useful. You can't carry on importing your medical staff from other countries when other countries are not producing huge numbers of children. Skip that. Last pictures. This is the Earth at Night map, which you will have seen drawn normally. The idea is that you have a satellite, it goes around the Earth, and you take a series of pictures, and you put those pictures together and you make a composite picture of what the planet looks like at night. And whenever you've seen this map, and you must have seen the normal version of this map, the message you're told is, here's where people live, that's where the lights are, and in the dark areas there either aren't people, there mainly aren't people to be honest, in the dark areas. If we take that map and we put it on the population cartogram, which is a map where everybody's given equal space, which means that the Sahara disappears because there's almost nobody in the Sahara. This is Moscow, by the way, in case you're wondering where that is. Then, if there's no light, that doesn't mean there's no people. There are people everywhere on this map, in equal number. Where there's no light, there are two possibilities. One is that they've got no electricity. The other possibility is they're not so stupid that they burn up power and use electricity to power lights to shine up into the sky. Whereas the bright areas are the most wasteful areas. If we come out worldwide, let's give you the whole world. You can see the brightest area when this was taken was Tokyo. And if you've ever been to Tokyo, you'll know why it's that bright. Because it's neon kind of heaven. They're not good. And you can look at this map and you could be incredibly fearful for the world. You could say, what's going to happen when the whole world lights up? The way I look at this map is I say it's a map about human beings learning. When we first got electricity, when we first had the ability to light our streets, we went haywire and just lighted everything. And what I want you to do is to look at Tokyo now. This is before the tsunami. We'll take it forward to Tokyo after the tsunami. And you'll see it's ever so slightly dimmer, more contained, because they had to turn the nuclear power stations off. Had a huge drop in electricity. They turned a whole series of lights off, and they also said that people like me have to use the stairs and not go up and down in lifts, which must be good for health. But at the same time as you see these parts of the world getting a bit dimmer, you can see, if I go back again, that's what the Nile looked about 10 or 15 years ago, in Cairo and Alexandria, and that's now. So there are other areas of the world which are lighting up fast. But there is no need, this is what I'll end up with, there's absolutely no need to have all these lights shining up into the sky. It's incredibly wasteful. there is a need for everybody to have light and electricity and be able to read. If we were back in 1968, and I was talking to you as a set of medical students, well, if I was alive, and talking to you at the same age as my dad was when he was doing your studies, it would be very hard to be optimistic. The main thing you'd be worried about wouldn't actually be world population growth. The main thing you'd be worried about is that we were just about to annihilate each other with these massive arsenals of nuclear weapons. The nuclear clock got to nearest to midnight in around 1984, and it's actually moved away since then. But we still have those arsenals of weapons. We still have climate change. We still have despotic governments. We still have war. We have more 18-year-olds, including a very large number of very, very, very angry 18-year-olds, than we've ever had. We have fewer 18-year-olds in Europe than we've ever had, and we still manage in many countries have no work for 50% of them. We have a huge number of problems in the world, but the one problem we don't have or haven't had for 40 years is runaway population growth. Thank you very much, and please ask away.
Thanks so much, Danny. I hope we're going to get lots of questions, please. I mean, I have one, which is about how many of you have heard that, you know, people say, oh, we've got too many people in this country, the NHS is unaffordable because of the demographic time bomb, the world is growing exponentially. How many of you have heard that? Yeah, most people. How do you respond when people say, we've got this demographic time bomb and the NHS can't cope?
Can't cope with it. We've got about 1% of the world's adults and we've got 0.5% of the world's children. So I happen to think it is rather silly to stop people, young people coming in, particularly young people who are going to have more young people. It'll be an interesting experiment to see how we do cope if we completely stop immigration. Japan shows you problems with doing that at the moment. The main thing about ageing is that people are getting fitter, much, much fitter as they age. So we have an incredible army of very fit 70-year-olds who can help look after our 90-year-olds. The majority of 90-year-olds are at home still. They're not actually in beds or in nursing care homes. And the other very positive thing about the population ageing is you'd hope it becomes more wise. When you look at people's attitudes by age, they tend to be quite greedy at fairly young ages. They tend to want more. Once they get past 60 or 70, they become a bit more magnanimous. And the lovely thing is when you look at the attitudes of 90-year-olds, who, in the surveys I've seen, have largely stopped worrying too much about themselves, or even their health, because they know it's going to be crap, and started worrying much, much more about other people and younger generations. So I think you can look at ageing as being positive. But the danger is, you can also look at ageing as being a huge opportunity to make a lot of money, because people's bodies do fall apart. So if you bring in a health system which rewards people by profit by the more operations they can do on somebody, then you are going to head towards the American system of what is 16% of GDP spent on procedures to do with people. So we've got to learn to cope with our bodies getting older, not trying to fix everything up, and not trying to live forever. One danger of the ageing is people saying, I really want to make it past 100 and I'm willing to pay anything for somebody to help me get past 100, which won't necessarily be a particularly happy life, even if it's a long life.
Okay, questions at the top. Can you have a microphone? We've got two microphones, I think. Yeah. If you could take that one at the top. And then is there any other questions?
Very recently, ONS has just released some statistics saying that over 65, the life expectancy is dropping. It's not obesity for the over 65s. They're still the skinny generation. It's I'm the oldest of the getting too fat generation. The reason why over 65's life expectancy is dropping is, I think, almost certainly austerity. We've had a big increase in 85-year-olds dying, women, who should have died at 87 or 89. They've been dying in poor areas. They've been dying where people can't heat their homes. So it looks to me like an effect of austerity. And it's the first drop in life expectancy since the 1930s, which is the last time we had this. We're lucky in this country in a way that we can look to America for what the effects of obesity are going to be, because they did it first. And as yet, it's not pulling down life expectancies in the more obese parts of America. Life expectancies are dropping in the poorest parts of America, not necessarily that correlated. But obesity is a learning thing. When we first had mass-produced cigarettes, machines that made cigarettes, it's really easy to smoke. We don't have to roll your own. And we had the First World War, which gave you a good reason to smoke. We had a huge spike in smoking. The middle class smoked like anything, and we had a huge spike in cancer deaths. The middle class learned in the 1950s that this is going to kill them. Large numbers stop. 30 generations, large numbers of the working class carry on stopping, and we're still on a downward trajectory for smoking. But it took us a century to learn that this thing, which was quite nice, is quite nasty, and to reduce it. We've only learned that if you create an obesogenic environment, some of us have got that special gene that means that we will get fat unless we behave ourselves very well. Others of you are a bit luckier to be skinnier. But it's a recent learning environment. So you've got a middle class who are controlling the weights of their children, even if they're a bit fat, and we'll get better at it. And we're also beginning to worry about what we put into food and what kind of saturated fats and so on. So I think it's a learning thing that will work its way through. It's because if you look at the obesity graph of kids, it's only from about 91 onwards that you see this takeoff. So it's a very recent situation we've been in when it's been that easy to get that fat that quickly. And we should learn about it.
Any other questions from the ground? Well, it's been reported that China's going to end its one child policy.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what effect you think that is going to have on global trends in population.
Yeah. My prediction is, well, I was going to say none, but I would expect fertility to fall even faster. Just before the one child policy came in, fertility was 6 per woman, and then it fell to 2. And then they introduced the one-child policy after it had gone from 6 to 2 for China. So it was already pretty low. Fertility is already, in the big Chinese cities, is down to 1 or none very often, partly because the flats are so small, a bit like London. You try and have 3 children in London and work out what income you need to fit them in. So my prediction is that the actual desired number of children has got this small, that we shouldn't see an increase. And in rural areas of China, there is a relaxation where you can have two of the first as a girl, and so on. And you haven't seen a huge take-up of that. So I think we're heading towards a new norm. And part, what I could do, how many of you are only children? You stick your hands up. Okay, which was very rare. How many have got one sibling? Okay, how many have got 2 siblings? How many got 3 or more? Okay, interesting. All right, when I was 1 of 4, when I was your age, 3 or more would have been the most hands. That was just what we were, that's what you had. You were told to have that number. The Queen had to have 4. It was the respectable number. Beveridge wrote a book about it. Particularly the upper classes, he wanted to have more because we had supposedly better genes. When my dad was finishing off medical school, my mum became a teacher, and she went to a lecture by a sociologist called Halsley. And Halsley told her and all the other women in the room, because it was a lecture given to people running playgroups, which were all women, he said to them, "You will all have 2 perfect children." Is what she can remember this. We ended up with a slightly larger family, because she didn't like getting instructions from old men. But in the late 60s and 70s, the message was two children, not four. And the norms change. And if you think about living or working in London or anywhere else in Britain, just look at house prices. Look at what a three-bed house costs towards a two-bed flat. Just think about how you would get that extra bedroom. So there's an economic incentive to be normal, apart from a normal incentive to be normal. I've got nothing against having lots of kids. It's just it's fine, I think, if the average has reduced.
Question there, and then another one behind.
The most optimistic I see is the progress on solar panels in China. So solar panels are getting much, much, much better. The other is talking to people in Denmark, where there are seven political parties, all of which appear to be green. Denmark is going to have half its electricity generated by wind within 6 years. And when I asked an MP what happens when the wind doesn't blow, she said, because it's normal to be female in Denmark as an MP, she said, we're going to smell. The washing machines just go off. And when the wind comes up, you can turn them on again. But you have to have an idea that as a country together. So there are those optimistic things. The other big one, given for how you could have more power, is nuclear, which I worry about slightly more, because when I was a geography student, this is the kind of lessons you don't get. When I was a second year geography student, I was taught how to blow a nuclear power station up by one of my lecturers. And the trick, because you're responsible, I can tell you, you don't hit the power station, you hit the little generator next to it, which will cool it down if it goes wrong, which is rather like what happened in Japan. So I personally have a fear about nuclear, and particularly nuclear waste in Sellafield, in that it's just such an obvious target for somebody who's very angry. But there's a big argument here, because nuclear's a really obvious one whereby you could burn light and have it everywhere, until you worry about the future, the waste, the fear. All paying the Chinese a massive rate so that you can have a nuclear power station at Hinkley Point, and then you don't have the wind power in the sea next to it. But I'm optimistic we'll be able to get lots more electricity. But we're going to need it. If everybody's going to be accessing Wikipedia, that's like, you know, running several light bulbs per person anyway.
Food sustainability. What if the rest of the world starts to eat as much as, say, North America?
Yeah. They'll get very unhealthy. And they won't have learnt. And again, another fortuitous thing. I mean, I eat meat, but not that often. If eating meat was really good for you, we'd have a problem, I think, because meat requires an enormous amount of grain to produce meat. If we're stupid and we don't learn, we have a problem. But all of these answers boil down to that. But if we're stupid and we don't learn, and we don't become more collaborative and more collective, we'll have enormous wars, we'll have pandemics that we can't control, we will have mass world poverty, we will have revolutions. Everything will go wrong. If we are cleverer, if we learn together, if we're more cooperative, we'll do better. And the last thing I'll say is, I have a little wonder about all these people who are not going to have children in the future. Margaret Thatcher once said something, that there's no such thing as society, there's only you and your family. What if you don't have offspring yourself? What do you have to care about? Now, you could become very selfish and just say, I'm going to live it up and be hedonistic. Or you could worry more about society in general, your nephews and nieces, and so on. So it's balancing on this. We could be stupid, in which case we've had it, or we might be learning, in which case we're doing better. And the evidence that we're learning are things like that population slowdown going on, because that correlates so well with women being accepted as human, and with people being allowed to go to school and then to university.
Got time for one last question, down there.
When you had the graph of the number of children per mother,
and by different countries, it looks like the countries that had a higher infant mortality tend to have higher number of unwed children. Yeah. Does infant mortality rate change lead changing number of children?
Yes, no, massively. One of the saddest arguments I often hear is that people say it's a real pity that infant mortality is going down, because if more babies died, at least there'd be fewer human beings. And you can see the sort of simple logic of it. But the data show really, really clearly that the faster infant mortality falls, the fewer babies people have. When my grandparents were born, which was around about 1900, 1 in 10 of the babies of the servant-keeping classes, the richest people in the big houses around here, their babies died in the first year of life. So one reason why the royal family and everybody else had 4 is you really only expected 3 to make it through, and then maybe only 2. The chances of any of your offspring dying in the first year of life are around 1 in 1,000. It's not something you really need to worry about. You need to worry about your children's mental health. You know, at least a 1 in 6 problem there. And then the country they're growing up in. But you don't need to worry. And we're the first generation that didn't. When I was born, it was 1%. It was 11 per 1,000 dying. And that just changed the calculations as well. So the faster that medics can help bring infant mortality down in poor countries, the faster families in poor countries will have fewer children. The other thing, just as important as falling infant mortality, is pensions. If you are not going to get a pension, you need to have children as your pension. Introducing a welfare state and having pensions in countries is another very fast way, which is why Germany is depopulating now, because Bismarck introduced pensions much earlier than everywhere else. Pensions means you don't have to have more children so that you don't end your life in poverty. Thank you very much.